planetaudio.org.nz. Kia ora. This program is brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard.
Welcome to the Black House, Wellington Access Radio 106.1 FM. You are in the studio today with Eddie and my very special guest, long time kind of guest on the show, Byron Williams. How are you doing, man?
I'm very well, thank you. It's been a while since I've been here.
I was going to say, when was the first time you came on the show?
I think it would have been 2020 maybe.
Yeah, that's
Yeah.
That's half a decade.
2020 or 2021.
Yeah.
2021 probably, 2022, something like that. I was working as a PT, that's how I met Leah.
Yeah.
And then
yeah, it would have been 2021 then, I think. Yeah,
something like that, yeah. So yeah, been a while.
That's
crazy. Half a decade, you're right. Half a decade.
Yeah, I had that moment with cut up some friends of mine from uni that I'm friends from my first year of uni, and then they were and I kind of clicked, I was like, we've actually almost known each other almost a decade now. And she was just like, that's really disconcerting. But
Yeah. I've had weird moments recently with, I don't know, man, I don't want to call it aging because I'm not that old, right? I'm not super old. But the idea, I realized 2026, it's been 20 years since I started high school.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's two decades. And recently, I had a kind of chance encounter with someone that I went to intermediate school with. It was same year as me, and I mentioned that, and she was like, "I don't need to know that. I didn't need to know these things." And I was like, "Sorry to ruin your day, but it's true." Just the idea of time, the passage of time, and then suddenly you're like, "Oh man, it's been X amount of time," and things.
Yeah.
And it's weird. It's weird, man.
And it's interesting. I feel like I've kind of hit that point of I've gone through. I think we came on you to talk about today to talk about your PhD research sort of thing. But I think it's something, especially, I don't know if you found it, but for me, being studying is it feels like you're in a limbo state, especially where I'm kind of I feel like I've kind of sat there and been nothing really consistently, nothing really big in my life has changed dramatically in that kind of last kind of 2.5 years because I've just had one kind of main project that I've been focusing on.
Yeah. I mean, it's, similar to my PhD, I've submitted over a month ago, and I had spent 4.25 years doing it, and it's a surreal experience. I haven't defended yet, so I'm kind of it's not overdone yet. I don't want to get too comfortable with not thinking academically because someone's going to be like, "What is this?" And I'll be like, "I don't know. I just chose it because I was stressed." So I don't know. But yeah, man, it's been pretty weird because a lot has happened in that time, but kind of not at all.
Yeah.
The main focus has been this. And I think what's really strange is I was really lucky to get a job pretty much out of the PhD. I was applying before I finished. But I submitted on a Friday and then started work on a Monday. And it was brutal, man. I've got an ID photo on at my new job, and I look exhausted. the light out of my eyes, they're gone, they're missing.
Yeah.
You know, the souls vanished somewhere up into the sky. I was tired, man. But it was, I realized for the first time in years, I was just working.
Yeah.
That was it. That's all I was doing. I wasn't, this is a part-time thing for PhD or I'm trying to manage thing. It was just
you're trying to balance work and study.
Yeah. I'm just working now. It's weird. It's the first time that's happened to me.
Because that's what I've got coming up. I've got that sort of I'm supposed to finish by the end of this month. Mm. And then it's good because like my like 2-3 days after I hand, I was like my final due date, is my birthday. So I'm like, okay, cool. So it's like I've got some, I've got a reason to be like, no, I'm not fucking extending any longer than anymore. But it's also just the case of that, like it's my birthday, so like I've got that kind of like. But also, I'm sitting there being like, I'm gonna have like 2 drinks and just be wiped, just because mentally I'll just be so exhausted.
Yeah.
But I think that's what I'm kind of I'm trying to, like originally when I was thought I was probably finishing a bit, you know, a bit sooner. Mm. My kind of original plan was like, you know what, take a couple of weeks off just to like literally just de-stress. But now it is, I'm just be like, okay, I'm gonna take a week.
Yeah.
See what I can take a week and then like properly into job hunting from there. Like.
Yeah, I feel like reality hits you pretty quickly though. I mean, that's what it was for me, right? Like, I mean, we've got a 3-year-old and I was like, oh man, I have to get a job.
Yeah.
Otherwise we will literally starve, you know? So, I know how you want to play, but you want to, you know.
I was going to say, do you want to just give us like the kind of rundown of your project of the last 4.25 years? Like
last 4.25 years.
You have 2 minutes.
Like, no. I mean, the funny thing is I was asked by my supervisor recently to co-author a chapter. Mm-hmm. I mean, by co-author, it's like write a few paragraphs sort of thing, which is pretty standard, I imagine, for co-authoring. But she was pretty much like, can you summarize a PhD and then make kind of like my final point, because I structured it through 3 analysis chapters, the main findings chapters, and the third one was kind of scoping it out a bit more to talk about these implications and what does all this mean. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of heading towards. So I say that to mean I think I'll be okay with summarizing what this is. Fingers crossed. I got some notes in front of me, but we'll see how that goes. I mean, effectively, I came to the PhD as part of a research program called WEDL. Which is also the Māori word for challenge, but also was an acronym for working. WEDL, working to end racial oppression.
Yeah,
that was the idea. So they were looking for a PhD student to do research in their kind of housing and geographies area. So looking at racism and how that functions, some of the stuff in there was to give you kind of a flavor. Was like talking to landlords and talking to property managers about racism and things, as challenging as that may be. And then then there was sort of like environmental racism and stuff. And they wanted a qualitative component that was looking specifically at the experiences of racism. It's like, how do people interpret what's going on and how does it affect their lives and their rental experiences? So I applied, and I just got quite lucky because my supervisor who was kind of running the program or running this PhD, I'd met him the year before.
Yeah.
I was invited to a conference. I tried to do a PhD in 2019 and it did not go well. So I dropped out and I felt like the biggest failure of my life. Yeah. Like I was just, you know, as you do, you know, you set out to do something and you don't get it. You just view yourself as like this big failure. So I was kind of floating around trying to figure out what to do. I applied to be a personal trainer, these things. And then I got randomly invited to this conference. And it was really small because it was post-COVID. It was just coming out of the lockdowns period. So they were like, oh, there's only like 10 people.
Yeah.
And we're going to be in one room and, you know, so that way we know how to trace everything, whatever. And they were just like, we want you just to talk on some stuff, you know, on racism and African experience thing. So I spoke about something that I'd kind of done with a group of young Africans and things and spoke about consent and things. But anyway, but yeah, so I met my supervisor there and he was really impressed by what I did. And he was just like, oh man, like, please, if you get an opportunity, do a PhD. This is our program, whatever. And I was like, cool, lovely to meet you, whatever. I'm going to go make some money being a PT.
Yeah.
Again, that's why I made Leah. And like, I mean, I made the dumbest decision of my life. I was doing quite well as a PT. Like, I really enjoyed the job. I was putting up a clientele. And then my friend was like, hey, I saw this PhD opportunity as housing and racism or renting and racism. You should apply. I think you'd be great at this. And I was like, oh man, I know nothing about housing, but I know racism, which is kind of a sad thing to say in a certain way. But like, I'll apply for it. That's cool. And it turned out that the person I met who really liked my work was the one who would be supervising me. So I kind of got through that. And the issue I kind of had was that I knew nothing about renting.
Mm.
I was like, oh no, I'm sure there's some ways that it's interrelated. It blew up to be much bigger than what I originally thought, as all postgraduate studies or all studies do it in a certain way. And so the program wanted to look, they didn't want people researching like away from their community, so to speak. Mm-hmm. They didn't want like a outsider looking in kind of look. Even though in research that whole idea of insider outsider gets complicated anyway, regardless of where you stand. There's so many ways you can be an insider and an outsider to any group or any community. So they wanted to kind of tailor it toward me. So we came up with asking the question of how do Africans experience racism as they like attempt to gain, maintain, and move in between their rentals? You know, what does that look like? Ultimately the kind of broader research question was like, what does racism actually look like for people on the ground? With a particular focus on Africans renting in Wellington. So I conducted 19 interviews with Africans who were willing to speak with me, people who identified as African willing to speak with me, but like with a particular focus on people who could experience anti-black racism, right? Like, I know that sometimes you're into this problem of, you know, maybe it's because I'm South African, Afrikaners in particular being like, but we're African. And I'm like, yeah, you are, I guess. But you run into, you know,
there's some nuances to that exactly, conversation as well.
Yeah, the experience is quite different, you know. Yep. And even in New Zealand, the experience you would receive being perceivably black or perceivably brown or dark-skinned versus being lighter or white, you know, there's colorism also exists within that stuff as well. So so that was kind of my main question. I actually had notes, but I've left my research questions at home, and I'm not gonna be able to pull it up in there, but yeah, so I separated up into, I think it was four questions, and then you know, it was kind of around like, what does it actually look like, what are people actually telling me these experiences are, what do people interpret them as, how are they experiencing, what does it do, and then I was thinking about like, you know, how do interpersonal, institutional, and internalized racism function in this kind of area, and then I can't think of a third question, but the fourth question was, you know, what does this tell us about the broader systemic operations of racism. So that was kind of like the kind of starting points for those, and the questions that I asked participants were kind of tailored toward that, but they were semi-structured to kind of facilitate a conversation. So if participants had particular areas they wanted to go into or areas they wanted to follow, we were happy to kind of tailor the conversation toward that.
Damn, that's, again, it's one of the things, like I said, I feel like that experience of kind of like going in with that sort of that those like kind of a base expectation of, it seems interesting. I think that's and obviously that is such a consistent experience of being like, oh, I'm sure I'll find a little bit of it. I'm sure there'll be a little bit of something, and be like, oh, and then just the depth of stuff that you're finding, sort of thing.
It was funny, man. Like, it took me, I mean, I still don't know everything about the rental sector.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's a particular spot of, the housing system in total. And I mean, even within that, like, I spent most of my time talking to people who were renting in the private rental sector.
Yeah.
There were some participants who were renting in public housing, council housing, or you know, government housing, whatever you want to call it. But I mean, New Zealand itself has about 80-something% of renters renting in the private rental sector, you know. So, you know, I guess I say this to mean, you know, even within the housing system more broadly, you've got a specific subset of people talking about their experiences with, like, you know, sprinkles of the public sector, but those are also not fundamentally different, but they have very different characteristics and styles to them that come out. So it's a big beast. Like, I learned a lot. I'm still learning a lot in it. But I would say that the housing system, the racialization of the housing system, and the way that people experience rents is very much a passion of mine now. It's kind of what I've kind of come out of it from a very personal point. So yeah, it's been good. But
was there like, 'cause I know I had this experience with my research, like, was there a lot of stuff that kind of just fell outside of the scope and outside of scope? You're like, that is still like,
yeah.
Obviously, that's a kind of, I guess, to feel like it's almost like a tail end, like, conclusionary question. It's like, what stuff did you feel like you had kind of had to, like, was there a lot that you kind of held into that? Okay, this is my what falls within scope, and now there's so much more on the outside of this that would have been so fascinating or could have been so interesting to get into, but
in the next few years, I've got a lot of folders on my laptop. In the next few years, I want to get into them to go, what are interesting areas that I couldn't follow because it didn't fit the research question? Some of them I can talk about now, some of them were identity.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly with younger participants, like there was a large degree... I don't want to say they were different understandings of racism, because overall they were very similar, mm-hmm. but there were kind of different ways of thinking about racism, if I could say as much, which seemed much more linked to identity for younger mm-hmm. participants. And like, you know, my initial thoughts around that were like, well, you know, like, I mean, I'm thinking about myself as well. Like, I came here when I was 10. So like, my parents were in their 40s when they left South Africa. So they've got a relatively fully formed identity of who they are culturally, where they belong, et cetera, whatever, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But for me, and it would seem for younger participants, was this, I wouldn't say sense of feeling lost, but it was more the sense of like, well, I don't really belong in New Zealand because of racism and because these exclusionary practices mm-hmm. and experiences. But I don't really feel like I belong so much to what I consider home. How do I form this identity? How do I, and like I said, it wasn't such a topic that was like, again, it was off the ball, so to speak, but it was very interesting to see people kind of grapple with that. And that's one thing I really actually want to follow up personally, more because of like my own story coming here and identity, whatever, you know, Kiwi accent, whatever, but I'd love to follow that a lot more.
It's interesting though, on that sort of point, because there's something that's going to come up in some of my reading on Rasta, especially as it spread in the UK, especially in the UK, where it's like, and it was almost a kind of separation. It was like Rasta came up primarily amongst either the people who migrated as kids or the children of migrants, versus, and there was a sort of, and in response, almost in response is a sort of thing of people's parents, the perception of coming to the UK was very much like, well, we're coming somewhere to, you know, somewhere that has more opportunities, or somewhere that's going to do is better opportunities. We're trying to forge a life for ourselves. And there were different experiences of racism that came up there, but then it was like the children of people who'd grown up in that system were like, no, we feel it much more keenly, and we don't, in a weird way, don't have the same sort of like, we don't have that comparative element of what back home was like, or the connection back home to be like, okay, like, I think that was an interesting, that's just that, what that kind of reminded me.
Yeah. I mean, I think you can very much feel like it's, I can understand older generations who are like, well, you have it so good, like, what are you complaining about? But then I also understand younger generations being like, well, we don't have any kind of level of comparison, and the kind of world that we're swimming in, so to speak, is this. It is this kind of understanding of contemporary racisms, of subtle racism, colorblind racism, these kind of things, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you know, my parents grew up in apartheid South Africa, so... You know,
it's very clear what that sort of looks like.
Yeah, they knew they couldn't go through certain doors. They knew that there were certain punishments for stuff. They knew that the socioeconomic limitations were very clearly laid out. You know, and like, but now like younger generations are, everything's a lot more subtle. Mm. Even if structures kind of produce similar outcomes.
Yeah.
You know, like I'm not having to, we can all walk through the same door.
Yeah.
The post office. You know, my dad showed me the post office in where he grew up, where he wasn't allowed to go in. He had to go through a certain door, you know.
Yeah.
He's shown me those things. That doesn't happen to me. But at the same time, you know, he'll have barriers to him getting where he needs to go economically, and I will also, but it will just look much different, you know? And as you say, part of that opportunity stuff, you know, part of the reason why I moved here, I mean, some of it was safety, but it was also like ease of access to education, you know, even if we have to get loans, you know, I got my issues with the loan system, generally speaking, but, you know, even if we had to get loans, it was a lot more straightforward than what was available to us in South Africa.
Yeah.
So, you know... They've set me up and my siblings are really well to succeed, but my brother and I were talking about this the other day, we still face barriers, but they're just a lot harder to see.
Yeah.
You know, they're not like a legal line of like, you cannot enter this job because you're not white. That's much more around, you know, names, skin color, norms, culture, that kind of stuff, all these things, all these weird exclusion practices, which weirdly is actually quite prevalent within the rental sector, is kind of what I found as well.
Yeah, because it's interesting. So, like, I don't know, like, talking on the rental sector here, like, I have a friend of mine who's English and his fiance is a Kiwi girl. And then, but I remember, like, when they were looking at flats, and I think they're still in the same place, and they might have moved, but there was, like, they were kind of looking at flats, and then they must have gone for a viewing, and the woman who owned the flat lived upstairs or whatever. Mm. And they were just like, and they kind of half jokingly said it, but they kind of somewhat, slightly, kind of serious, were like talking about she was very clearly looking for a young white couple. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. To live yeah. in her flat, and I, so, and it was, and it was like not like, and then there was also almost that question of being like, is this that sort of when you get into some of those kind of bigger questions of like great replacement theory or that sort of thing? Is it you're like I want to give an opportunity to this young couple because then they'll go on and do X, Y, Z. But it was interesting, like hearing that. I think that was like, because I think we might have actually spoken. I think we might have had a chat with you, but I feel like a lot of my interview with you, I was just chatting shit. I don't remember too much of it, but I remember that was one of those stories that I remember encountering, like, when it was just after they'd moved to Wellington. And I think it was interesting, so like when you were kind of going through those sort of obviously like those interview kind of process, mm-hmm. like what sort of kind of themes and stuff sort of emerged?
Yeah, so I mean, and it's a really good opportunity to talk about, so like the way I sort of wrote my PhD was I mean, there's a lot of work you have to do in a PhD. Like I actually had to do two lit reviews in a certain way.
Yep.
One of them was like contextual, one of them was analytical, and then, you know, obviously your methodology and, you know, trying to make it as rigorous as possible, etc. And then I got into like kind of the main findings chapter. So I didn't actually have a discussion chapter because my findings chapter kind of served as that.
Yeah.
But so the first one was like, what's going on? Like, what happens when you go to these places? And it's interesting that you mentioned, you know, this, the kind of story you told, because in the literature, there's this idea, there's this term known as like the ideal tenant.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really hard to talk about this without kind of speaking about like what the aim of the private rental sector is in a certain way. You know, like with the government largely abandoning its kind of large scale provision of housing. Yes, they still provide public housing, but as you know, even the council itself is struggling to provide that effectively, and are oftentimes going into third party managers because they just don't have enough money.
Yeah,
there's not enough money for an effective and a useful public housing system. And so the government since the 1999, more so 1990s, had relied heavily on the private rental sector, which has seen also the kind of massive speculation of housing. Housing in New Zealand has always been speculative. You know, property has always been speculative. That's part of the reason why land was taken from Māori, because it was speculative. We can make more money from this, you know, the land itself. But so, you know, this has always been the case. But prior to the 1980s, New Zealand, the government actually provided quite a fair bit of public housing and also supported home ownership a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the mechanisms, there were a few mechanisms where they did it. It was kind of a combination of like the government and private equity and whatever. But one thing they did was actually they provided loans, low interest loans for lots of families. Māori were largely excluded, which is something we should really not forget about. We shouldn't paint this, you know, this 1930s to 1970s kind of beautiful vision of everyone had a house. It's like, no. Māori had relatively high home ownership, but they were largely excluded from the way that the government sort of provided for people. And I kind of give this background because what it kind of paints the picture of is since the 1990s in particular, private property has become extraordinarily lucrative.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're going to provide housing to the private sector, you sell housing to people. People can buy housing and then rent it out. So our housing system itself is quite heavily dependent on private rents.
Yeah.
And so if you have to privately rent, if people are buying a property to make money from it,
the house
itself becomes an asset.
Yeah.
You have to do what, under capitalist laws, perhaps logic, you have to do whatever it takes to protect that asset.
Yeah.
What is viewed culturally as dangerous are ethnic people. The safest tenant, the ideal tenant, is usually pretty well-off people who don't have many children, who are quiet, who have well-paying jobs, all those kind of things. Stereotypically, who fits their bill?
Middle-class white people.
Middle-class white people. That's who people want to rent to. You know, at the risk of oversimplifying this, that's kind of who people want to rent to. So what that kind of means in terms of, and I want to give the background because I want to explain the context in which these people are kind of going to rental viewings and things. So what you see quite often is it's very important to get an audience with the landlord.
Mm-hmm.
if you want to get a rental property. Rental viewings are relatively public. You know, they have things where people, lots of people can go in. You know, people are all looking. Kind of like, you know, I've been to lots of open homes and I don't enjoy them.
Yeah.
But you're weirdly there with like a whole bunch of people who are all desperate enough to be like, I want a house, please help me out. I mean, that's even more so in the rental sector, you know. It's like usually people who are looking at open homes to go buy something, they're kind of in a position to buy. They're kind of in a, well, so they're making decisions. They're not saying, I'm desperate for a house, I'm making decisions. And some of that is true for the rental sector, but what you see many racialized rent, people, they've been trying to look for rent for so long that they're kind of desperate. So you're kind of going into this place kind of begging in the first place to a certain extent, if not practically, ideologically. Do you know what I mean? So you need an audience with the landlord or a property manager to some extent. What we saw a lot was that people were just flat out ignored.
Mm-hmm.
They were just ignored. They were avoided. And when they did speak to them, they were kind of like, oh, yeah, you know, didn't really give full answers, didn't really want to engage with them all that much, made it pretty clear that even if you apply, you're probably not going to get this property. And this kind of experience was compared with people who went with Pākehā folk. I had a participant spoke by his cousin who had a white partner. And the treatment he got was just so much better.
Yeah.
You know, like he was engaged with, he was spoken to. Oh, yeah, you're put in a position where you're going to legitimately be treated as a kind of a legitimate option for tenancy. You know, the kind of feeling or vibe that people got largely was that people just didn't want them as a tenant there. So that in itself kind of eliminates people the opportunity to even get into the conversation of becoming a tenant.
Yeah.
And this wasn't just like... occasional experiences. People spoke with this happened
consistently.
Often. And they become really numb to it. Like, it was kind of like, oh, you know, like, it's going to happen. You know, I've got to present myself in a certain way, whatever. Which, you know, simply taking a step back, like, the idea of going to a rental to get shelter, which is a human right, the idea of having to go to that in your best outfit is crazy. Like, that in itself is wild. Like, you're, like, applying for a rental property in the same way you're applying for a job. It's kind of crazy. But that only makes sense in the background of this is a speculative asset for a landlord.
Yeah.
Therefore, they want me to be a good tenant to protect the asset, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think talking about the whole ideal tenant thing is such a fascinating, because I think, it's one of the things where, like, just the logic so clearly tracks if this is an asset, then... Because it's, I almost find it sometimes, like, when you think about that sort of thing of, like, people, like, when I've seen things about, like, landlords or people not wanting people who are at home, or, like, part of, in a weird way, I've heard someone talking about the kind of backlash to people being working from home is actually, like, in part, there's a dimension of that is... about that asset sort of thing. Also, if you're at home so much, then, like, obviously you're using your house a lot more.
Yeah.
So then it's like, whether it's
wear and tear over
where the tear increases, because versus, like, and I think when you talk about, like, oh, you know, people who are working jobs, if you've got two people working sort of thing, cool. Like, you, realistically, pre-COVID, that meant you were out of your house for 8 to 12 hours of a day sort of thing.
Yeah, right. I didn't even think about it that way. Yeah, totally. And even when people, you know, because some of the assumption, we'll kind of get to a certain point as we move on, but, like, even the assumption that, like, black folk or Polynesian or Māori, like, aren't working is also part of what it fits into that narrative, right, that idea. But, like, even when participants put themselves in the best position to get a tenancy, some of them still didn't.
Yeah.
You know, like, I had a participant who was, like, actually I had two participants who were talking to me about, like, oh, you know, I mean, one of them was like, you know, I've got really good income, two people are working, I applied for this place, and I didn't hear anything. I eventually go back to them, and they said, oh, you know, who's applying for this place? And they were like, oh, no one so far. Okay, cool, well, I'm willing to pay the amount that you've asked for and more, because the property manager said, I think that the price may be a bit too high, so people aren't interested. And she's like, cool, I'm willing to pay more.
Yeah.
If that gets me into the property, I'm willing to pay more. Okay, cool, we'll get in touch with you. Never heard back. Eventually calls up, oh, sorry, the property's been taken.
Yeah.
Da-da-da. A week later, saw it again, advertised on wherever she had looked before. And, you know, and so it's like, well, you've put, and this didn't only just happen once, it happened to her again. She was in a position where they met the landlord, said all these things, and eventually they were like, oh, sorry, nah, it's been, you're not who we're looking for.
Mm.
You know, so you've got, I mean, there's two things to say from that. Like, this was relatively consistent. Like, it was like, oh, sorry, the place has been rented.
Yeah.
Then it's available a week later, or even less than that. And this is also found in international literature, that many people of color or racialized people put themselves in really good positions, and suddenly they're like, oh, well, sorry, yeah, it's been rented, and they found out just that it's not. And they've even been, I mean, New Zealand doesn't really have audit studies, or audit study is like, you know, it's used a lot in a more employment in the States and in Europe, where, you know, they send into exactly the same CVs, yeah, but put like a ethnic name or like, yeah, a local name in there. They do that in renting as well, where they'll apply with the same name or with not the same name. They apply with the same credentials and then see what, yeah, yeah, different names, and they get called back. New Zealand doesn't do that all,
yeah,
that much.
Yeah, yeah. Because I think that was when you were talking about that sort of like the whole, like, whether it's showing up to a viewing in your best clothing sort of thing. And I was starting to think, it was like so much that just feels like it's the same sort of process, like when I've had friends who've been like, yeah, like, I changed my name from like my African name, yep, because it, yep, gets like for my on my CV, it gets me, yeah, through the door, sort of thing.
Yeah.
Or like in a weird one, like I joke about it, but like when like me and my fiance have gone to booked Airbnbs and stuff like that, we usually go under my name, yeah, because my name is like my last name's Welsh.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
that's,
yeah,
like,
yeah,
my, yeah, like, you know, my name is, I'm Edward Enyan.
Yeah.
That gets me.
Mm.
And I'm still like, and it's that kind of thing, and like it's versus for her where she's, yeah, Sri Lankan Tamil. So there's like, just to have that difference in sort of like, oh, okay, cool, like,
yeah,
let's just see if this gets us through the kind of door.
Yeah. I mean, that points to one of the analysis points that I made was that like the ideal tenant is not foreign.
Mm.
The ideal tenant has to fit into sort of ideological ideas or structures of what is, what belonging is, who belongs here, who, and some of it is deserving, like, who deserves this house, but, yeah, it is this idea of like the risky tenant, you know. But I mean the point the point of this chapter, so this was the first chapter, like I kind of just described, it was very, very descriptive, I described what people were going through,
yeah,
and these were quite common, being ignored. Stereotypes was huge. And I had someone tell me that a landlord questioned if they'd lived in a house before. Someone had their references called and be like, are they trustworthy though? Like, are they really? You know, so, and like, I was reading through the data, I was reading through the kind of points that I found really fascinating, and the sort of the theming that I had up was this idea of like stereotypes. But I remember having so much trouble trying to figure out, like, what am I labeling this? What am I talking about here?
Yeah.
Like, I could get the theme. The theme was about stereotypes that were very prevalent. People seemed really resistant to rent or live near black people. Mm. A few participants had told me about neighbors who were just really unhappy that they were there, and they were surveilled a lot. They were complained about more so than others. They were said, "Oh, you're not keeping your room nice and whatever," even though your house, even though it was tidier than everyone else's, yeah, and things. And eventually, they worked to get this one particular family kicked out, and then just to find out later that it had been, they were like, "Oh, the owner's coming back. Sorry," which is legal. You,
yeah,
know, owner's coming back. We're going to live in the house. Whatever, that's fine. You can give notice for that, even under Labour's
government. Yeah,
That's pretty standard rental stuff. Which again is, I don't know, kind of crazy a little bit.
Yeah, like,
kick you out of of where you're living so I can. I don't know. Ownership is the king under capitalism.
Yeah,
but so just to find out later that the place had been rented to another white family. You know, so it's like you know, there's pretty clear indications. It's hard to say this is obviously, but it's pretty clear indications, yeah, that they are unwanted in the area. And a lot of the kind of punitive actions against them were related to the stereotypes that people view of black people.
Yeah.
So I was...
Yeah, because you kind of touched on, like, obviously the kind of, like, that question of, like, do we have, like, the laziness or the work and sort of thing? Because obviously, like, I know, like a lot of... The stereotype for a lot of Asian people and experience for a lot of Asian people within the housing market, especially if you're South Asian, like India, Sri Lanka, sort of things, is often like the food that you cook, like the curry smell sort of thing. And like, what were the kind of stereotypes that sort of came out? Like, obviously, there was questions about trustworthiness or questions about kind of like what was the sort of like stereotypes that kind of came out about African people in that way?
Primitivism?
Were they just the kind of the kind of classic sort of...
Very classic, like primitivism. People assume, like, you know, the assumption of not living in a house before, like, oh, there's no way you could look after this house. Stupidity, the assumptions. And this was in renting as well as other places. They kind of just assumed that they needed help to do things. Like, they even had... someone explained that, you know, they had flatmates being like, oh, I'll teach you how to use a knife and fork. And it's like, what? Like, this is insane. So, I mean, that, to me, combines primitivism and you know, ideas of civilization, whatever, da-da-da. Or, you know, so that was big. untrustworthiness, like assumptions of criminality were quite big. Assumptions that you were going to cheat them, those kind of things. Like, you know, oh, you'll be a bad tenant because you're not going to pay. Those kind of things. Assumptions of being poor was huge.
Yeah.
And people just assumed that you had no money. Weirdly, assumptions of everyone being a refugee or former refugee was really fascinating. Because, you know, that is a story of Africans in New Zealand, but it's not the story or the only story.
Yeah.
You know, there's, you know, it was this kind of, you know, that idea of everyone being a former refugee kind of spoke to me about like the way people view Africans as homogenous. It's one singular
one kind
group.
Of block, yeah.
Yeah, which, as we know, in our community, there are a diversity of ideas,
yeah.
a diversity of places people come from, language, etc. Like, that's just so, there's, it's so much more nuanced and so much more diverse than people made out to be. That was quite typical. What was the other one that I was thinking of? I think it was just the idea of like being dirty. Dirty and being untidy and being unable to take care of a home. Which was really, that one was really fascinating. So all these stereotypes kind of came up together.
Yeah.
But what was really fascinating for me was that there were like, I mean, I had, like I said, 19 interviews, and there were like up to about 6 participants who were like clearly outlined that we as Africans are tidy and look after our stuff, which was so fascinating because you've got these like broad macro stereotypes that are like directly contradicted by people themselves, and those people themselves link their tidiness to them being African.
Yeah, it was like. The guy with, I had a guy, Horace James, on last week. He was a Jamaican guy. And he's like, every Sunday, like, I've heard my dad talk about this, my aunties and uncles. Like, every Sunday, like, from like 7 a.m., he's like, I am up, I clean my house.
Yeah.
Like, I clean the place. Yeah. And he's like, and it's consistent. It's like, every Sunday, like, he's like, my dad would put on, like, reggae from the 90s, 80s and 90s sort of thing. I get up on Sunday morning, like, it's like, my partner really, like, used to get really annoyed by it. It's like, why are you up at the crack of dawn on Sunday playing Chronics while you clean the house sort of thing? But he was like, that is a consistent Jamaican experience.
That's
thing of being like, like, every Sunday, crack of dawn, like my dad was like, my dad was like telling me the songs that his parents used to play while they would clean the house on Sunday.
My father would consistently, every Sunday, he'd get up early, and I'd wake up every Sunday to jazz music. And it's because he wasn't just cleaning, he was scrubbing.
Like, yeah.
Scrubbing the place out. So, you know, like, it was so interesting.
It's such an interesting one of, like, that internal, so that, like, here's the external stereotype versus, like, the kind of internal cultural perception sort of thing. I mean, like, of course we do this. This is like...
Yeah, so, like, the assumptions that there were going to be really poor tenants who couldn't take care of the property or be tidy, people were so aware of it. They were so participants were so aware of it. But they themselves were like, I don't know why they would assume that, because, again, we've grown up. And yeah, like, they did, some of them did point to them. They're like, oh, family members taught them how to look after property, look after things. You know, that was such a normal experience. So it was really funny that, like, one participant was like, oh, you know, I take care of my stuff, and then I see these, like, you know, young white boys getting properties easily, and they're trashing the place. You know, they had this kind of thing spoken about as well.
So, like, like Dunedin. Like, Dunedin was like a prime example of that. Where, like my, and again, like, I think I remember, like, when me and my friend Fiance first started seeing each other, like, we kind of, there was, between the hall that I worked at and her flat, there was one big flat called Debacle, and Debacle was, every time, like, it had, like, a big front-facing piece, like, big, and with, like, probably, like, 8 or 9 kind of, full kind of big windows on the front of the building. And every time, whether it was, like, I was walking to hers or back from hers, almost without fail, 6 of those 8 windows would be smashed in.
Yeah.
And that flat did, those boys in that flat that year did $20,000 worth of damage.
That is insane. And what is so funny about that, too, is that and this is kind of a point. Maybe I'll kind of end the first chapter and kind of move to the second one with that point. You know, a lot of these stereotypes, as like I said, I was trying to figure out. You know, like I said, the theme was stereotypes, but I was like, what is the takeaway from this? Like, what is the thing? And what I realized, again, this was funny because I didn't realize until I had a conversation with my white supervisors, but it was because I had become so numb to racism and to this experience that I couldn't. I wasn't able to elevate above it because I was like, oh, but this is normal. I couldn't
see something unique
about it. And the more I spoke to them, the more I spoke to a friend and the way I thought about it, I was realizing that actually what I'm seeing is anti-black racism. Mm. Like, I'm seeing anti-black racism turn up time and time and time again. And participants themselves were aware that it was anti-black racism. They weren't just like, oh, this thing happened to me and I don't know why I'm such a victim. They were like, no. The world doesn't like black people. Mm. And they have stereotypes about us and they think we are all like this, and that affects and shapes our opportunities to gain access to rental housing. That's, you know, not in those words, but that's pretty much what they told me. They were like, this is not isolated. Mm. This is part of a broader system, of ideological system that understands us this way.
Yeah.
And therefore, we are treated as such. You know, like, they weren't blind to it at all.
Yeah.
You know, so like I said, I was looking at the data and I was like, what is special here? And eventually I was like, actually, anti-black racism.
The whole thing.
That's what this is. Yeah, that's like, I think I was trying to get too into the details and I was like, it's anti-black racism.
Yeah,
like, that's what we are seeing. You know, and that's kind of what I think I spoke. I'd love to talk about this more, but I remember I spoke to you about how I started theorizing what does anti-black racism look like specifically in New Zealand. Mm. And again, that's another point that I wasn't able to really touch on itself. I wasn't able to touch on. I've been thinking about this without actually talking about it in the PhD. Like, I have specific perceptions of what I think anti-black racism looks like here,
mm-hmm.
but I'd love to have broader and deeper conversations with more people because we all experience it to certain extents. So I'd love to hear, what do we think is happening here? I don't have my notes for that now. We can talk about that in the future.
We've got a couple of episodes.
That's one point. So effectively, like, that was the end of the first chapter. It was like, what are the experiences? And then when I analyzed, the analysis was basically, what we're seeing here are sort of the persistence and pervasiveness of anti-black racism. We are seeing it everywhere. We are seeing it shape people's lives. We are seeing it be the catalyst of whether or not people get rental housing, whether they stay in them, and how they're treated while they're there. That's, you know, anti-black racism was core to all of this. Coming back to the point of the houses being smashed in Dunedin, the second chapter was kind of like, what are the effects of this? Like, what's happening to people with this? And, you know, how are they dealing with it? How to get around it? I've written some notes for this. I'm trying to remember. It was like, what are the effects? And like, one thing that actually came out from it too was kind of talking on that point was like, what I saw was that like, racism seemed more important, like, to uphold in certain ways. I would assume unconsciously or maybe subconsciously, more important than like the money you could gain from the asset.
Yeah.
You know? Like, what we were seeing with those participants that were like, oh, I can pay more, it was like, not having a black person was more important than me making more money from this asset. Which is like, because that contradicts all the logic here, right? That contradicts the logic of it, of the
if the purpose of holding this piece of property is to maintain the asset, is to continually drain more value from this asset, right? Surely this is actually a better thing.
And if people had gone beyond, be like, actually, Africans themselves view themselves as being really tidy, this would be a perfect tenant. Someone who's willing to pay me more, someone who can look after the property, someone who might even improve it, who I might have a really good relationship with, that's a good tenant because they can be there in the long term. No, the blackness was an eliminator. Like, that was crazy to me. Like, I was like, this is wild that this is actually happening. That, like, the stereotypes are so deeply entrenched into society, but also into the individual mindset, that like, that in itself was an eliminator from gaining more money. That was crazy.
Sorry, just the thing that kind of makes me think of those guys in Dunedin, like, that was, because then it almost makes it feel like, when it comes to that sort of trade-off, where it's like, it's almost like, oh, like, and obviously students, there's a degree of like, they don't fit that kind of ideal tenant kind of model as well. But there's also that kind of degree when that sort of stuff came out, and especially the destruction of flats in Dunedin, or especially the destructiveness of it. So much of my perception of that was very much, and it was almost always white private school boys who would, in those flats, would destroy them, and then they'd usually be staying, they'd actually be living predominantly with their girlfriend and not paying rent. But like, but it was that sort of thing. It was almost like, I almost describe it, it was like the kind of the whole rite of passage of it.
Yeah.
How many people were just like, well, that's what you do. You go, like, if you go to Dunedin. But then it's that sort of thing of being like, I don't know how many non-white people could have gone into those environments, done the same thing, and had the same perception kind of come out about them, sort of thing. So it's almost like, and I think when you're talking about blackness being that eliminator, it's almost like then that whiteness or that kind of rite of passage sort of mentality about the thing in that case in Dunedin then becomes a sort of, it becomes almost like a bit of a write-off of the loss of value to your property.
Yeah. Like, I mean, it was really, they're like balancing like cultural norms and values and the maintenance of the cultural structure, that they're balancing that with the asset value, right? I mean, I assume a lot of those properties already paid off, you know, so they...
Oh, definitely.
They're not paying a mortgage on top of that. Gosh, I've lost the point that I was trying to, that I was thinking of.
Oh, we're trying to think.
But yeah, like, it seems... Oh, no, that's what I was going to say. It felt that, like, the blackness itself, and this isn't exclusive to Africans or black people, that itself was a justification to be punitive. It was a justification to punish people.
Yeah.
You know, and you saw this a lot more in the public housing examples.
Yeah.
Some, obviously, some of them were good, but one quote that came out, again, this is part of chapter two, one quote came out was like, I wondered if I weren't black, would I have been treated this way? You know, like... Because there was just this sense of like, it was a lack of care of people's lives.
Yeah.
And again, this was compared to other ethnic groups. You know, like the amount of like policing that was done to certain black families seemed above and beyond what happened to other renters who weren't that, who weren't black. And this isn't even like, I mean, this person wasn't actually living around. I'd love to see how it would work for like Polynesians and Maori.
Yeah.
There's a very specific kind of historical. Historically relevant racism that comes along with that, but you know there were what was described as an Asian family and a Pakeha family, and they the Asian family would kind of get sort of policed, but not all that much. The Pakeha family not at all, but this family and another Ethiopian family were like policed heavily in the public sector, and some of that is down to some of that is also related to like the way that society here views. I mean, the UK is very similar, right? How they view public housing, how they view public housing tenants, you know, the residualization of public housing in itself, where, you know, the threshold to get into public housing becomes so low that if you're in like a kind of all right job, you can't get into public housing.
Yeah.
So the people who are left behind are the people who are very well, not well off at all,
yeah.
who are really struggling. And the tenants themselves know this. You know, the tenants themselves understand the risk that comes with that, you know. And this wasn't lost in some participants. Some participants were like, you know, I'm living next door to someone who is a former drug dealer. Not that I have a particular issue with that, but it's dangerous for my kids.
Yeah.
And also, I know that if something goes wrong, the police are going to be slow to respond. You know?
Yeah.
So it's like this. They kind of forget about these communities. And then when they live in those spaces, they're just like very aggressively policed.
Yeah.
And this again, this isn't just... It becomes... The systemic aspect is, I think, to me, far more interesting and fascinating. So like, you could argue, oh, well, yeah, okay, the society is sort of very capitalist, very sort of like... pro-entrepreneurial and like, go out there and, you know, pick yourself by your bootstraps and go do all the stuff out there so that you can argue, oh, well, they just police public housing tenants generally. Yeah. Fine. We'll go with that argument. That's fine. But who are the people most likely to be living in public housing and why?
Yeah.
You know, so like in New Zealand, the stats does show us that you're more likely to be living in public housing if you're Maori, Pacifica, Asian, or from the MELA category. And we do have Asians with the MELA category more generally. But some of that with like Maori in particular, it's the continual effects of dispossession that you can trace back to the 1800s.
Yeah.
You know, and the ongoing inability for them to gain any kind of wealth, especially if New Zealand, if property is a really good speculative asset, take away people's property. They can't gain that much wealth from it. You can get into income, but also there's racism also in the employment structure.
Yeah,
you know. So this is when it starts becoming a system. Okay. You start seeing these kind of trends that are kind of going across or more. So you know, who's most likely to be in those in that kind of housing, and why?
Yeah.
You know, so you ask those two questions, you're starting a systemic analysis, which I think is a really good thing. I mean, I know I'm biased. I'm a sociologist who thinks about systems.
Yeah.
But I think it's really important to go, all right, well, if statistics tells us something, why and who? Those are two good questions to ask. Why and who? And what you're starting to see is people who live in public housing tend to be poorer people. Poorer people tend to be from economic, from ethnic minority communities. And there are usually historical and contemporary racial reasons as to why that is the case.
Yeah.
That's not to put a blanket stereotype on every single African person, because there are many African people doing very well. But if you also look at rates of home ownership, I think it's something like 60-something percent of Africans do not own a part, own their home. We can talk about the legitimacy of stats and what issues we have with that, whatever. But that's what we have to work with. So the answer, what I'm kind of saying effectively is there are usually systemic reasons why many people who are African do not own a part, own their home, and why many African people tend to live in public housing.
Yeah.
So when these public housing are extremely policed, very, very punitive measures, lots of policy that kind of doesn't really help them much at all.
Yeah.
You're inadvertently producing racially in not inadvertently. You're producing racially in inequitable outcomes.
Yeah,
because you can't think of things. You can't think of policy specifically aimed at housing without understanding the broader systems that produce who lives where. Those kind of things. that's kind of bordering into my third chapter a little bit more. But thinking about what kind of effects these have. There are systemic ones and there are interpersonal ones.
Yeah.
So we kind of touched on the systemic ones, but what we saw a lot was... Timmy, let me know if I'm going on to
6 minutes.
All right. What I found a lot was that people were basically like, they were struggling, man. Like, emotionally. There was a lot of resistance as well, though, in certain ways. Like, I spoke about like internalized racism. And what I kind of found was that people didn't internalize racism in so much as they understood what what the barriers were.
Yeah.
And they would respond accordingly. But what I kind of found was that how effective your response to it or how effective your ability to avoid racism in the rental sector kind of came down to a few things related to money, privilege, English language skills, whatever.
Yeah.
People were able to choose a bit more who they rented from. People who are poorer can't really do that. People were able to strike up relationships with landlords prior to getting there. That relies on you speaking English very, very well and having a pretty good knowledge base of a whole range of topics. People who don't speak English particularly well and who have come here from war-torn countries, that's not a priority.
Yeah.
I'm not thinking about, let me go chat to you about New Zealand rugby.
Yeah.
No, I'm traumatized because I've come from a place that's been shot up the whole time. These are the things that kind of come through. People would describe things that they described as, anxiety, depression, those kind of things. And I think the theme to take away from this was that what I kind of realized was that racism was a very, important addition or, sort of notable addition to an already punitive system.
Yeah.
Like, the rental sector itself was really punitive in the first place and very selective and kind of really difficult to navigate. And racism was just this additional barrier that was not just like a small one. It was like a huge additional barrier, but it was in addition to everything else. And that was really tough. But people really showed, participants showed a really interesting sophistication and understanding of what the barriers were, how they occurred, what they thought about it, what they didn't like, what they liked, all these things about the system itself. And then even anti-black racism and systemically, they were these things are systems. They weren't just the person just didn't like me. It was no. There are structures that produce these stereotypes of Africans. That kind of brought us to the third chapter, which we kind of spoke a bit about. But the way I entered, it was basically about why is all this happening?
Yeah.
Even if there's anti-discrimination laws, I looked specifically at the Residential Tenancies Act, the anti-discrimination clause specifically. And it's tied to the human rights. I think there was 1986 maybe the original one came out. And then there were changes, amendments in the 1990s, which aligned with the Human Rights Act of 1993. Mm-hmm. Basically making it illegal to discriminate upon the race on the basis of a certain degree of particular categories. And the only mechanisms to challenge it was through courts, basically, or mediation.
Yeah.
And what you kind of began to see was that, the way that racism is dealt with formally is, it has, it's obvious. You can just go to the courts and they can talk about it.
But that feels like such a slow process where if you need housing, part of that is, part of the issue of that is like, that's it. It's hard, almost in my head, but the minute first, immediate second, I was like, that feels like a very slow process to something that we're like, if you need to live somewhere, you can't really afford a slow process like that.
It's slow, it's expensive, it's time expensive, and it's loaded with jargon and legal expertise, which many people, regardless of where you're from or whatever, don't have.
Yeah.
Like, understanding legal stuff, it's a very specific kind of education, but also a very specific kind of, like, niche hobby, you know? Like, to understand law that specifically is actually pretty tough. So, like, you've got the, like, the speed issue, and you've also got the, like, entry issue.
Yeah.
And what you find quite often is many people just don't complain.